Hi, this is Brendan Davis from Bedrock Games and the Bedrock Blog, and I'm here with Adam Balderstone, and we are talking about Babylon 5, Season 5, Episodes 8 through 10, Day of the Dead, In the Kingdom of the Blind, and A Tragedy of Telepaths. So, Adam, why don't you walk us into the first episode, and then we'll just get into the discussion.
Okay, well, this is a notable episode. It's written by Neil Gaiman of Sandman and American Gods fame. And it's the first episode since the second season that's not actually written by Straczynski, too, which is noteworthy.
Now, has that become regular during this season at this point, or is it just a one-off where they brought him in for some reason?
Just the one-off. I mean, this was, you know, Sandman didn't end that, you know, far before this, so he was free to do things again, and his name was pretty big at the time, so they brought him in.
Okay. And does Straczynski stop writing the episodes himself after this point,
or I'm sorry, I was taking you from the wrong answer. No, every other episode in this season will be a Straczynski episode. He goes back. He just gave one episode away. That's it.
Okay.
He's keeping the rest for himself. But yeah, as plot wise though, this is we get Rebo and Zooty, who we've heard of throughout the show, finally make their appearance.
Now we did see a little clip of them before though, right? But was it not Penn and Teller at that point?
I don't remember seeing an actual clip of them.
Maybe people have talked about them. I thought that there was a TV in the background and you could see two guys that were Rebo and Zooty, but maybe I was just imagining that because of what I had, you know what I mean? I could have just been imposing that from my memory.
It could be. I don't remember that because I think I would have lodged onto that, but I don't know. That's one plot line. And then we've also got the Brakiri by a section of Babylon 5 for a religious festival where dead people come back and talk to people, which is kind of basically broken up into several different plot lines in this episode. But yeah, what'd you think of this one?
I actually liked this episode. I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was definitely it felt like the Halloween episode, and I didn't know Neil Gaiman wrote it, but now that you told me, I can absolutely see how that's responsible for a lot of the change in tone. But it was a change in tone that I thought, I don't know, it mixed things up nicely, and I think it kind of, it was a nice shake-up before the stuff that we're about to get into. It's like a palate cleanser episode in a lot of ways, you know, helped you kind of, you know, rest a little bit before the big telepath storyline. So I was fine with it. I thought Lockley was a little bit idiotic in how she, the whole arrangement that they reached with the Brakiri.
That was very, it seemed very unlockly. That is the one big flaw in this episode. It's like Lockley's this really kind of uptight, by the rules person. Oh yeah, I'll just sell you a whole section of the station. Sure. It just, it wasn't believable for her character.
And I feel like Sheridan has just not been attentive to Babylon 5 enough as president. I know that he's got other responsibilities, but I feel like the Lockley thing does not seem to be working out. Is not in terms of the actress, but in terms of the character, I feel like she is not making good choices. And this is one of many that
I'm kind of giving her a pass on this choice just because it is, like you say, this is the Halloween episode kind of feel. And it's like, well, we need to have this happen. So we're going to make Lockley do this. Cause I like the Lockley plot, the main plot in this with her and her dead friend. I thought that it's kind of felt believable to me that it's like, oh yeah, she was someone who had this kind of wild teenage years, and then her friend died. She became this really kind of focused, uptight. That all felt very believable to me, and I felt the other actress in that plot line was very good, and it just So yeah, I on the whole, I thought this was a good Lockley episode. But
I do want to point something out, because with that backstory, she basically says that she was like an addict or something, right? Like, was that the impression that we were supposed to get from
that?
She
was definitely using drugs. Yeah, definitely.
Because that means between her, Garibaldi, and Franklin, you have three former users on the, it's, you know, it just seems like a large number for the kind of occupation that, you know, I mean, you don't tend to associate, I guess what are they like, high echelon military folk? Like you tend to be clean living sort of people. So, it feels weird having three people like that on the Babylon.
Yeah, it is. You're right. It is. Definitely getting to be a stretch, but you know,
but
in isolation,
it was the 90s, and like,
it was,
you know,
the 90s. A Neil Gaiman episode is going to be a very 90s episode, so but yeah, I don't know, like I said, I like the Lockley plot line. The Lanier Morden plot line, it's really weird to me that Morden would show up to Lanier. It was a weird choice, but on the other hand, I liked having Morden back, and it was kind of fun seeing them interact, so I liked it despite that.
That was my feeling, because I felt like, well, there's got to be like a Mimbari somewhere who would have been more appropriate to bring back. but yeah. I kind of missed having Morden in the show, and it was enjoyable to see the actor playing the character again. Also, I think it's clear that they're taking Lanier down a darker path, and so Morden is the appropriate character for that purpose. And it was also, you know, what was kind of cool too, was seeing Morden kind of try. I don't know if he was trying to help or gloat, but it was like he was trying to help him. And granted, it's not actually Morden, but I don't know. I thought that was kind of a nice touch, because it allowed the Morden character to come at things from a slightly different angle than he normally has been used.
Yeah, no, as he said, all I ever did was try to help people. That's all we went around doing. But but yeah, it's that worked well. I mean,
do you think that's true? Do you think if like you sat down with Morden and talked to him, that would be his sincere belief, or do you think that someone?
I don't know. I mean, he's a little more calculated than that, but I mean, to an extent, he's not a strong person. I mean, he is the person who, when, you know, one of the people, when the Icarus, you know, ran into the shadows, he's the one, I'll help you guys. I'll work with you. I mean, he is on some level just a total collaborator. You know, he's not the mastermind or anything like that. He's the guy who, he just wants to get along. He's just gonna work with people. So, you know, which isn't really a moral trait.
But also by the end of that Shadow and Vorlon conflict, it did kind of get more gray anyways, because of mm-hmm. what we learned about, you know, we learned the Shadows weren't necessarily the evil that we thought they were. Not that they were necessarily good either, but that they weren't as you know, that it was really more about, you know, chaos and law rather than, you know, good versus evil. And so, you know, I think they introduced enough gray that you can give Morden sort of a room to view what he's doing in a certain light. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the Shadows are pretty terrible in a lot of ways, but I think the grayness comes, a lot of it comes from the fact that the Vorlons, the more you learn about the Vorlons, the less good they look.
That's
they're
what I'm saying.
Perfectly.
Yeah.
So it's, being opposed to the Vorlons becomes more justifiable when we see more of them and see more beyond just Kosh. But it's so yeah, I mean, it's a complicated thing, because the Vorlons winning wouldn't have been great either. But yeah,
no, and I'm not saying that the Shadows were in the right. I'm just saying that there was definitely it went from seeming like it was about sort of angels versus demons to mm-hmm. something a lot more difficult to really pin down in moral terms.
And, yeah,
and And so I think that gives Morden room to sort of be like this guy who sees what he's doing is helpful, because he just, you know, he's sort of like the Leta Alexander of the Shadow Team. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's... I wouldn't ever dream of, you know, I never thought of Leta as an evil character because she was working with the Vorlons. I thought of her as a good character because she believed that she was doing something to help humanity. And that was a totally reasonable conclusion. So I could sort of see, you know, give somebody slightly different experience and put yourself in Morden's shoes. You might, you know, if the show had been following, you know, Sheridan's ex-wife and that crew on the ship instead of Babylon 5, maybe we would feel the same way about Morden that we felt about Leta. So that's sort of the angle that I was coming at it from.
Yeah, he is an intriguing character. It's but yeah, and once again, there's the question of, you know, what is this phenomenon we're seeing? How real is it, and all of that too. But
well, that's what I wanted to talk about. Really, that was the bit. But so before, just in case people are listening, they didn't catch it. The section of the ship on the Bracari Day of the Dead gets transported to Bracari somehow. It's very unclear how all this happens. But yeah, they buy temporarily a section of Babylon 5, and then it gets transported to the Bracari homeworld. And during that time on the Festival of the Dead, which happens, what, once every century or every two centuries or something, the dead appear to people. And, I mean, this genuinely happens. They get visions of people that were alive and talk to them, and they have sex with them. Like, you can interact with the dead in a very tangible way. The thing that the show makes clear is this probably isn't a ghost. It's probably some other phenomenon that just isn't understood, or is like a really advanced technology that the Bracari just, you know, are using to manipulate people. But it's a very open question. It's totally unclear. And so I was curious, what do you think they are? What conclusion did you draw?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's enough information to actually draw a conclusion. I mean, before we get to a final conclusion, I think it's worth talking about the other plot lines too. Because, I mean, we get Londo with Adira Tyree, and we get Garibaldi with Dodger. Garibaldi and Dodger seemed another odd one too. Because it was like Dodger's like this woman he met once, and then, you know.
I think the problem with him is, who else could they give him that was
dead? I know.
I guess, you know what? They could have, what was the guy's name? The boss that he worked for on Mars. That would have probably been a good choice.
Yeah, that would have been that actually would have been an interesting choice. But my other problem with the Dodger Garibaldi plotline too is that, you know, the original plotline with them is, oh, you know, they have a night together, and Garibaldi's all kind of ambivalent and kind of doesn't want to go through with things and stuff, and she gets upset, and that's pretty much the exact same thing that happens this time. It was just like, it's like, I feel like we're just watching a variation on the exact same thing that happened last time. And
there was something interesting though. She said, they were talking about, like, when they were having a conversation about what this actually was. And she says, oh, I don't think I'm actually a ghost, 'cause I don't believe in ghosts. I think this is just some like some kind of psychic, you know, impression or something like that. And I was like, that's a really peculiar thing for a person who isn't a ghost to say when they're supposed to be convincing you that they're, do you know what I mean? Like when the idea of this is that they're sort of there as a, I don't know how to put it, but it to me, what at least signaled to me is that this probably isn't just going on in Garibaldi's head. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I'd say the difference there is, I mean, I think kind of what you're saying, you know, she's not an immortal soul. There is kind of this projection thing, but it is just kind of a psychic impression, you know, because I mean, psychic powers are a genuine real thing in this setting.
Psychic powers are real, and there's also those soul hunters, and so
that's true. Yeah,
and so I guess I don't know. I feel like Straczynski does leave enough room for you to sort of fill that with whatever you want. Like, you could sort of say, well, okay, that's just, you know, it's just a explainable psychic impression that this guy has, and but at the same time, you could say, well, that's just a soul then. Do you know what I mean? So I think you could sort of look at this scene and say, oh, well, she's just a psychic impression. And you could say, okay, well, she's just a ghost. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Once again, it depends how you define ghost, because there's the whole parapsychological term of, oh, well, ghosts are just these psychic impressions left of traumatic incidents and stuff. So
but the fact that she's holding on to a key trait of her personality and is able to reach a conclusion with new information, that's the part. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's not something I would imagine a psychic, just like a vague psychic impression to be. That to me feels like this is a system. Like, this is a personality that is, you know, whether it's stored in a machine, whether it's stored in the universe, whether it's a soul and a ghost, doesn't really matter. But it's a personality that Garibaldi is interacting with, and he's able to give her new information, and she can do something with that information to generate a new thought. And it's in keeping with her personality from when she was alive. And so, I don't know, I just found that interesting. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool that she, you know, and it might have just been they weren't even thinking about it, and I'm just sort of reading into it. But
no, I think there's something there, definitely. Yeah, I mean, you're right. That conversation was interesting. I'd say that was kind of the high point of the interaction between those two. And I mean, the Londo one, I don't know if it adds a whole lot, but it feels like, oh, it's just this, it's nice that Londo gets this nice moment before he really, really moves towards the end game here. Yeah. It's kind of the show giving him a gift. It's like, there you go. You get one moment of happiness that you missed out on before you make your horrible sacrifice.
that was the thing that I took from that too. I just thought, well, that's nice. Londo has his moment with Adira. It felt like something that everybody wanted to see that never happened. So you got that. And like you said, the Lockley thing worked too. I guess there really weren't many options for other dead people to throw at her anyways. So,
I'd say they had the most because they could have given, you know, because they just invented a character, they could have given her anything. But
I guess that's what I'm saying. There wasn't an existing character in the show that would have made a lot of sense.
Oh, no. You couldn't have gone with an existing character without creating some unknown relationship that would have felt weird. But
yeah, like sharing his wife or something. Like, you know, like, yeah. I guess that would have made sense because they probably did have some kind of knowledge of each other. But other than that, that's the only person I could think of. His dad. But no, his dad's still alive, so that wouldn't make sense, right?
Yeah, I think it's true they were just married for a few months, too, so I don't know how much their parents would have, you know, if it was kind of an eloping kind of when they're young, I don't know how much she would have gotten to know his dad. But yeah, he's still alive, though. You're right. I don't know.
Yeah.
We went a little slow today.
That's okay.
But I don't know. But that, I enjoyed this episode. This is actually a case, too, of me enjoying an episode more than I did at the time, because, you know, when this episode first aired, it was like I was still like really into the whole what's going to happen with the big plot, you know, and this being a, you know, being an episode that, you know, is just kind of its own standalone thing. I was like, oh, you know, now I've got to wait a week before we get back to the story. But
and we are kind of, we're almost 20 minutes in on this one, so I want to get to the next one, but I think we shouldn't forget to talk about Meepo and Zooty. Yeah. Because that was a total surprise to me. I had no idea. And it even took me a second when they first showed up. I was like, wait, is that somebody, is that guy trying to be like, is that like Penn? Is that just like, you know, like I thought they were just guys that were made to look kind of like them at first. Because they were young enough that they looked different enough to me. So, but it was, I don't know. What did you think of the choice of Penn and Teller for,
It was an unexpected choice to an extent, but it kind of works from the standpoint that if they were going for kind of a classic pratfall kind of thing, it's like being stage magicians, it's like Penn and Teller are, that's within their wheelhouse kind of thing. They are very good at physical comedy. I actually saw Penn and Teller once live, but a long time ago. But I thought it worked. I wasn't, you know, I feel like the plot line ultimately with them isn't very interesting. It's like, oh, we're thinking of going into politics. And it's like, no, comedy is very important. It's just like, okay.
It felt kind of vanilla. I felt like you could have gotten more interesting route with those guys.
That's it. It's like I enjoyed them being there, but I didn't feel like the show knew what to, because it's funny, you know, it's like they're in this episode of the Day of the Dead, but nothing happened. They're not in any way interacting with that plot. They're just kind of this side thing, and they you know, they were interesting but superfluous at the same time.
I did like that they had that whole thing about how they studied the humor of different alien races, and so they were able to tell a joke and to Delenn that she understood. And it was very unclear what the actual joke was, but like it was, but they did a good job.
Of sort of,
yeah. but showing sort of like how different humor can be was I thought that was kind of nice. And again, you know, I mean, they were fine. It also felt, you know, this was sort of like, I guess, 90s Penn and Teller rather than sort of current Penn and Teller, which is a little bit different. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a difference there. And so it has almost a different meaning than if it were Penn and Teller from today. I feel like if they did Penn and Teller today, they'd be more like elder statesmen of their craft. And so they're, you know what I mean? I think it might've actually worked better now than it did then.
I can see that. Cause yeah, they didn't have that sense of being, you know, they hadn't been around that long. They probably had been around since the '80s, but still, but yeah,
it's the longevity that they've managed to achieve as a fixture that I don't know, in the '90s I felt like, you know, I'm Penn and Teller something I might not hear about in 5 years. Do you know what I mean? Like
they were kind of faded at this point, because I think I probably saw them around like 93 or something, and they were, you know, they first kind of hit the scene, they'd be on like David Letterman and stuff a lot in the '80s was kind of where they made their name. So yeah, they weren't very visible at the time they appeared on this show.
Well, didn't they have that show on HBO, or did that come after this?
I think that's after
that
this.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's probably at least 5 years after this.
Bullshit? Was that the name of the show, Bullshit?
That was the name of the show. Yeah. So yeah, no, it's definitely pre that. And but yeah, I you know, it's kind of, it feels like, you know, like going back to Sandman with Neil Gaiman, it's like part of the point of Sandman was exploring stories and the importance of stories, and how dreams are these stories you kind of make up in your head, and how stories motivate people and stuff. And so the kind of last message that, no, comedy, you know, comedy's really important. It felt like just a really, you know, Sandman did a great job with showing the importance of these kinds of things on a huge scale. This was like, it was like the message condensed down to the point where it didn't feel particularly profound anymore.
Well, also Sheridan was delivering the message, and he felt like maybe the wrong vessel for that lesson. Like, I could see Jakar sort of delivering.
Jakar would have sold that.
Yeah,
because they didn't give a. I felt Jakar was kind of off note in this. It's like Jakar is like this very intellectually curious person, and it's like for him to just be like, "Oh no, this is terrible. I'm very, very concerned about this." It was just like, I don't feel like that's how Jakar would react to this. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, but also with the comedy thing, like, I don't know if I trust Sheridan's sense of humor, and you know what I mean? Like, there's just that too. He just kind of felt, he, like, even when he's laughing, this might be deliberate, but he feels like a little bit out of touch. Do you know what I mean? And so, I don't know. I mean, it was fine, but like you said, it was kind of a condensed message. And if you're going to condense a message, I would hand it to Jakar. That would be my, you know,
yeah,
he can kind of sell anything like that. Sheridan's not as good at selling those kinds of thoughts.
No, they're Jakar. He gives a speech and you're sold on it. So, but
speaking of Jakar, actually, I don't know if it's the next episode or the one that follows it, but
next you kind of blur together a little bit. So
yeah, so the next episode is The Kingdom of the Blind, which kind of does sort of pay, like, they both, I viewed these as one storyline, really.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a fair
there are two storylines, but they're both evenly split over two episodes, so
okay. Yeah, because you have the storyline of the telepaths and the storyline with Londo going back to Centauri, right? And those are the two main threads.
Yeah, so this is the episode with as far as the Centauri plot line, this is the one where they first get back there, they meet the regent eventually, there's a assassination attempt on Londo, which is interfered with. And yeah, and it's kind of them kind of discovering things that are really kind of dark and sinister there. And the this as far as the telepath plot line, this is the one where Byron is arranging to get to speak in front of the Alliance so he can make his terrible, terrible pitch.
And he does make his pitch, right? This is
He
the one
does
where.
make his pitch in this episode. Yeah,
Well,
that's the
can we talk about these two episodes together as one piece? Because I feel like I'm going to
Let's do
start.
it.
I'm going to
Sure.
bleed them together, anyways. But so I was delightfully surprised with the course that Byron so far has taken. Though I will agree with you, the speech could have used some reworking in the
Oh yeah. It's terrible. I mean, within the context of the universe, it was. I think it was a believable thing he would do, and
Oh yeah.
it worked in the show. I just like, oh, Byron,
Yeah, no,
no.
it wasn't bad writing. It was bad behavior on a character's part in terms
Yeah.
of you shouldn't be doing this. This is a bad idea. Because he could have got what he wanted if he went. Well, number one, they kind of did a little bit of a cheesy thing where Sheridan just completely restates what the president of Earth had stated to him. Where, he did it the inconvenient way,
I know, I know.
and so it was a little too on the nose. And also, I feel like, I don't know, would Sheridan really do that? Like, would he just fall into that behavior after being on the receiving end of it himself? Like, I can understand
Yeah.
reluctantly do it, but it just seems like you would be so conscious of of how bad that is because it happened to you that you would want you the more believable thing is he goes in the opposite direction and makes a big mistake because he's trying not to be the president of Earth.
Sure.
But
Yeah, I feel like Sheridan is, I don't know, he is almost kind of in this plot line, he I don't know, there's just no empathy from him at all.
I mean, and I do understand the predicament, but I just feel like given the situation, like well, I guess number one, I want to know why is it so difficult for them to give him a home world? Like, what is the impediment? That was something that I felt they didn't clear because the way that when Byron was saying it sounded like, well, there's like, it's easy as pie, and then Sheridan is saying like, no, it's like impossible. And I want to know the details so I can sort of evaluate who's more right. And I didn't feel that I was getting that. I didn't understand what the complications were. I had a sense of
Yeah.
what they might be, but I kind of wanted to know. Like, well, maybe there are. Like he said, there's like all these homeworlds that are, there's like places, like habitable places that, that they could just give to them. And do those belong to somebody? Are they in dispute? Do they have resources? Like, what's the actual details?
Yeah, I figure it's kind of a situation. I mean, this is speculation. There's plenty of empty worlds out there, but they're all with it, somebody's already put a claim on all of them. So, you basically have to get someone to give you one of those worlds. And I mean, from Sheridan's perspective, even though he's the president of the Alliance, he's kind of in the awkward situation where, lots of his members have got empty worlds, but he, as president, doesn't have direct control of any of them to hand one to him. He'd need to give someone in the Alliance or Earth, which Earth would not do it. Give them a planet. So I think it's kind of a case of him, he personally doesn't have that power at all, would be the situation.
No, and I kind of assumed that was correct, but I didn't. They didn't get into it. And I thought I don't know. I just
Yeah.
wanted to sort of know what the deal was, and I don't know. I just kind of wanted to know what the inner workings of this process would have been that he was sort of, throwing a wrench in by giving the speech. Because if it is, because Sheridan was saying it was the inconvenient way, indicating there's another approach that could have worked. And so I don't know. If this is the inconvenient way, I think it should be explained why it's inconvenient. Do you know what I mean? Like what about
It,
that tactic makes it now impossible? But why would a softer tactic have worked?
well, yeah, I mean, I think there could have been like one little scene added to this that would have made it play better, which is, which you could imagine is happening off screen and we didn't see it. But, with Lockley getting the delay for the telepaths, it's like, okay, we've now bought this time, now we can come up with a better solution in these 60 days. It would have been good if we had some scene of Sheridan and Lockley trying to put together a real plan to help them. And then if Byron did this, like, oh, you totally blew up our plan, but we didn't get a sense that Lockley and Sheridan were actually doing anything. So it felt, it didn't, I mean, Byron, it still looked like a bad move, but it didn't feel like he was ruining a better move.
No, and that's, I guess that's the thing. And again, there was sort of that delay, that time delay that Lockley got, and they don't really talk about what, like they surely that must have been a pressing matter, but it didn't feel like it was true. It almost felt like they just ignored it, like it wasn't gonna even matter, or I don't know. I just did, but all that said, I like this episode. That was just one of my quibbles there. The thing that I liked about Byron, though, is I liked that he didn't. I thought, and maybe I'm wrong because anything could happen in the next two or three episodes. I don't know what direction. I don't know what trauma is gonna, happen and send the character in a different direction than you expected. The way I was imagining all this play out is I was imagining a sort of falling down scenario with Byron, where he goes from being this man of peace to becoming a man of war or terrorism because of something that happens. And it seems like he's still holding on to this idea of, we're going to do this peacefully, and this is the, and we're not going to do it the way that the humans normally do, the normals do it. We're going to do it our way. And I like that he's stuck with that through this up to this point. And that the problem has been the people around him not adhering to that program. That to me works better as a story than if it were like him spiraling out of control. And I realize there's still plenty of opportunity for him to do that and for that to happen, but I think it's more satisfying if that doesn't become the outcome.
Of course, because he has stuck to that, but of course, doing it our way, meant that they've used their telepathy to steal all these secrets that other people don't want. And they've basically become the exact fearful figures. Everyone that's afraid of they've made themselves exactly what people are scared telepaths are. So he's interpreted his own code in the worst way possible while still sticking to it.
No, and that's true. But I think that still worked because it was like,
oh, it does.
It was so, number one, it's a really effective tactic if used well. It just wasn't used well in this case. But it was also, it was the exact right thing to set people off and have them beat up the telepath and cause the divisions within his own rank. I just thought it worked really great. And again, it doesn't have to pan out in his favor. I'm not set on his tactics, on his man of peace thing working out in the end. What I'm interested in is him remaining that man of peace, because I think it's the thing that makes his character, it makes his character respectable and likable. Like, it's the thing that it's the reason. Like, there's a lot of stuff you could complain about with Byron, but if he's like, he's got this sort of core approach that he uses, and it's the thing that attracts Lita to him, and I don't know. I just feel like it's nice to keep that in place rather than for the purposes of story making him become a madman and
Yeah, well, there wouldn't be anywhere interesting to go once he. I mean, because the whole point is that Byron's not in a particularly strong position anyway. So it's like, once you make him a villain, it's not like he's a difficult villain to beat. If he completely loses all sympathy, it's like, okay, he's just random bad guy of the week at that point.
Yeah, and I like that he's constrained by his principles, because it's like you said, like the most forceful thing he can do is he can steal people's secrets and threaten to expose them. And that's, I mean, that's pretty bad. It's like a very aggressive move.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's hardly a violent act. And so it's the most aggressive thing Byron could possibly ever do within the boundaries of the character they've established. And so,
it's another thing too, where, to this group of telepaths that are living together, it seems like amongst the telepaths, because they've grown up with these powers, they just spend a lot of time sharing their thoughts. It's like they just seem very comfortable with that. And so the absolute terror of having your thoughts invaded that non-telepaths have, I don't think they really get that entirely. I don't think they get how scary that is to other people because they've always kind of shared these thoughts amongst each other. So.
And what was cool about it is the people, what was really frightening people is they didn't know what thoughts had been picked because they really weren't sure how deep these scans were and what they were thinking. Like nobody really remember, oh, maybe I was thinking this weird thing. Maybe I wasn't, I don't know. And so it was the paranoia that it created. And again, it results in some of the telepaths breaking away from his program and going to protect a telepath that's getting beaten up by, I forget which group it was, but some group of aliens decided to take some action, and I think they end up killing them, right? They end up killing the
at
aliens.
Least the Drazi, I think,
was
were doing
Drazi?
It, or
so they kill some Drazi, right? That's the and so you now have this splinter group from the telepaths, and it was also cool how they were aware of this attack as it was happening. That added that made you realize just how different this group of people are. You know, there's, as soon as it happens, they all get this look on their face, and that was effective. And now you have this, and so it started out. You had this one guy who was kind of the leader, the breakaway, but now it seems like there's another guy who's really taking control. But basically, there's dissent in the ranks, and what ends up happening is some of the telepaths stay with Byron and sort of do this sort of, I guess it's like the ultimate sit down. You know, it's like they basically wall themselves off, and anytime people try to go in and break open the section of Babylon 5 that they're in, they project like imagery of bombs and they just, you know, they can't. It's just this really prolonged process of extracting them. But there are these other telepaths that are roaming around, and nobody quite knows where they are and who they are, and they're the ones that are really making people nervous. And the one thing I will say about that, the one bit that I didn't like is at one point you see one of the leaders spray painting Free Byron on the on Babylon 5, and then he's the one that kind of commits to going down a really violent course of action. Well, I didn't mind that. What I disliked was the Free Byron spray. That felt like a really weak thing to do. Like what do you do? Like, what is that gonna? I don't know.
It was that. Yeah, that in itself was pretty weak. But I did like that. You know, it made the splinter group that was going around being violent. I like the fact that they're still doing it in Byron's name. I think that was they're not going to listen to what Byron wants, but they're still kind of using him as a symbol.
That's true. I guess if you take that Free Byron out, you don't have that information. So that's.
Yeah, I think that's what I took from that moment. But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty cheesy kind of. But then again, you know, you only have to look at any random photo of a protest, and most of the things people write on their signs are going to be pretty cheesy. So
that's true. No, I just felt like they're so scary because people don't know who they are and where they are. You know what I mean? Like it's not like people are so by going around doing that, they're exposing themselves needlessly. Is sort of how I was thinking of it. And also just like what effect is it going to have? Like, you know, oh, Free Byron. Okay. Like, you know, you could have done something more ominous that would have frightened people.
It's going to make those maintenance guys from a couple episodes ago pretty pissed off.
That's
I'll tell
true.
You
They're
that.
Gonna have to,
They're going to lose his sympathies.
We might get a whole side episode on them washing down the But I thought this was a great episode, especially when Bester comes back, Lockley. And this is, I think he comes back in the third episode.
The third episode Bester shows up, yeah.
But Lockley is like, okay, like people are going to die. And this is the other decision that I was like, why is this woman in charge of Babylon 5? You know, she contacted Bester and, you know, brought him back. And you just know that it is not going to work out well. But I will say this, there was something interesting that happened when Bester showed up. Number one, he was Bester, and I really like seeing him anytime we get him. But number two, he kind of made clear to Zach, like, no, like my people are in there. Like the telepaths that you're trying to extract are my people. You're not my people. Like, we are not in the, you know,
not on the same side here. Sorry. Yeah.
So Bester, I mean, I was like, well, maybe Bester has way more sympathies for what Byron's trying to achieve than I'm realizing here. Like,
Yeah, his views are complicated, definitely. But yeah, I just want to make an aside too that people that go, "Oh, don't bother watching season five." It's like season five has the most bester of any season, and if you don't want more bester, I don't even know why you like Babylon 5. So.
But yeah, I'm enjoying season five. I think I can again I can see sort of how like you don't necessarily need episode like season
You
five,
don't need it,
yeah,
no, but
because it's
there's.
you get the big story arcs in seasons 2 through 4, I feel. But again, for me, like you said, the season one stuff I think really laid the groundwork for the enjoyment I got out of the later seasons. And season five to me feels like a really solid epilogue, and it's got some interesting episodes in it. I'm enjoying them. I mean, it would have been great if they were able to structure the series differently because they didn't have to worry about being canceled, but that didn't happen. And so they had, they ended season four where they ended it, and they had to continue on from that point. And this is about, I can't imagine another way to make it any better, because it's sort of like, you can't do this big crank up in a single season. It would have felt really weird. It would have felt like 24 if they had been like, okay, we're gonna go balls to the walls and have it, be just like season four again. You getting that all in one season would have felt really like the melodrama level would have been enormous, and the it just wouldn't have worked. What they're doing now, it feels really solid. It's engaging me. It's got a really cool storyline with the telepaths. It's showing you sort of the complexity of dealing with Babylon 5 after the events of season 4, and I'm enjoying the lead up to Londo's thing. Again, I don't know how this season's going to pan out, so I can't really, I don't know how, but so far I'm enjoying most of what we're getting, with the exception of that what was it, Mac and Bo? What was that
Mac
other?
and Bo, yeah, Mac and Bo, that's their name. Couldn't think of it earlier. But yeah, of course, there's another plot line we haven't touched on, which is the whole Raiders thing, and the members in the Alliance being concerned about their ships being attacked. So.
And it seems like these raiders are probably those folk that are involved in Centauri.
That seems possible, yes.
And so this is the part that I'm really enjoying, the stuff with Londo when he goes back there and the Regent's acting all weird, and we know he's got that funky thing on his shoulder that's controlling him. And basically, do those folks have a name yet? Have they introduced a name for?
They have not given a name for them yet, no.
Okay, so I won't. But basically, whoever's sort of manipulating the Regent has taken an interest in Londo, and he's next in line to become emperor, and so we just know that like he's going to end up in the same situation as this regent, based on the premonitions and what everybody's saying. And that's a really dark direction to take Londo, given everything his character has been through. And these past couple of episodes have been really enjoyable because you get a lot of that intrigue related to that. But then you have this whole situation that arises where they find out that, was it N'Toth is in a prison, and she's just sort
That's
of a
right.
forgotten prisoner from the reign of Cartagia, and they have to free her. And I don't know, I enjoyed getting the closure with N'Toth.
Yeah, it was the original N'Toth too. It's not the second season N'Toth, so
And
I like that.
which N'Toth did you prefer? Did you prefer the
Oh,
first?
first season N'Toth. Yeah, that was the N'Toth I liked.
And yeah, again, we hadn't really seen much of her, so I thought that was an interesting surprise to,
Yeah,
I don't
I'd
know.
forgotten about that actually. I'd totally forgotten that she came back at the end here. I was like, so yeah, that was interesting.
And I like the way they discovered it, like where there was some fresh spoo, and I guess only Narns eats fresh spoo, and so Jakar just sort of unthinkingly grabbed it from a tray in a hall where he found it and was eating it. And over the course of the conversation, Londo says, "Oh, spoo needs time to ferment. You have to let it acquire its flavors." And
It's an insult to a Centauri to offer them fresh spoo.
but then, Jakar realizes, oh, there must be another Narn somewhere. He's like, wait, where was this spoon heading to? And that was a really cool way to sort of get to the cell with N'Toth. That really was mysterious and interesting, and it turned it into an adventure. I really like that.
Well, it's funny actually. There's an interesting point with this going all the way back to the first episode, because, you know, in the very first episode where the Narn have attacked that Centauri planet and Londo's upset, and Jakar tries to play nice with Londo, and the thing he does is he goes, would you like some spoo? It's fresh. And, you know, so putting it in the context of this episode where it's, that's basically, you know, Jakar, you know, insulting him. But, that's pretty entertaining. But yeah, having the closure on N'Toth was nice, because she was a very significant character back in the first season. So it was good to give her some closure.
I'll go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, and we get the thing where Lockley sneaks into the chamber with the telepaths, kind of invited by them.
Invited by them.
And then she, you know, they have an interaction. Nothing really comes of it, but it turns out that Byron basically wanted to say goodbye. I don't know how true that is.
No, that worked for me. I was like, oh, that's, you know, it doesn't move the plot forward or anything. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of a nice moment.
Well, it was an interesting moment, because he says, you know, he's like, she's like, well, why did you want to say goodbye? And he's like, well, you know, we haven't really got along, but you've been fair, and so that deserves comment. And so that was it was kind of an interesting gesture on his part. And so, you know, this obviously that the telepath plot has not resolved, the Londo plot is not fully resolved, but I'm interested in where these are going, and I think these are about the level of plot this season can manage. I think it's working.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to pile more on. Yeah, I should note, too, that the end of this episode, I think the end of the last episode we watched, we do actually see the Centauri ships. You know, that is made explicit. We see the Centauri ships out blowing up other ships, too. So.
Oh, yeah, no, that's true. That's true, because he gets because Londo's sort of been investigating I think there's some kind of expenditure thing going on where there's unaccounted for resources. And so, and some guy ends up getting murdered trying to dig into this information. And so, what was his name? John Doe or.
Cause we didn't do the podcast on Sunday. I watched these back on Saturday. I've forgotten the guy's name.
I can't remember his name, but he ends up, they get him to, like, they make it look like he kills himself, but he definitely didn't. And I don't know, the intrigue on Centauri is enjoyable. Again, it's always very I Claudius when you go to Centauri. I think it's I think it's quite enjoyable. I'm trying to see if I can find that guy's name, but I'm not able to do it on the. Jano, is that it, or Jano? Jano.
I honestly don't recall his name, so I don't know if that's right or not.
Okay, well, whoever he is, he ends up. You know, he's somebody that Londo clearly knows, but he's just introduced for this one little section of story.
Yeah.
unless he made an appearance and I didn't realize it.
But, I think he was new. I don't remember him.
But I like when they kill that guy and the regent shows up in his chamber and he's acting all weird. And he's like, you know, he's like, and by the end of it, he's like, I just wanted you to understand, you know, I wouldn't have decided to do anything to harm you. It wasn't, you know, if I had the choice, it was a cool scene.
Regent was great in this. Yeah, the Regent's gone from the little harmless character to like being genuinely creepy in this season.
But he's still the same guy. I like
exactly.
I like that he's like that man is still trapped in there, and it's obvious why they want Londo instead of him. Do you know what I mean? Because this is a guy, he's still thinking about the drapes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's just now thinking in terms of darker color schemes.
and so it's Yeah, well, it's I mean, that is part of the horror. It's like, I mean, it's bad this happening. This happening to Londo is a pretty terrible thing. But having this poor guy who, like, he never did, he's just this guy who never really did much of anything to anybody and is just trying to get by. I mean, it's just like, oh, it's terrible.
I mean, he kind of, his personality is like similar to the personality of like your friend's mom. Do you know what I mean? Like that is kind of like the so the level of sympathy you tend to give to him is at that is at that, I don't know, he it's very difficult to watch him have to endure all this. And so I think it's effective, like you're saying. It's he was given this position because he's pretty harmless.
I know. That was the whole reason. Let's give this to someone who'll just, redecorate.
He's not vindictive. I like also that Londo sort of gets suspicious because the guy was drunk, and apparently that was a sobriety was a vice that he cultivated, was the way Londo explained it.
Well, it's interesting too because Londo is the one who put this guy in this position. So it's like Londo's kind of it's kind of another mark on Londo because Londo wanted to dodge being the emperor for a while. He put the region in this spot, and the region's paid this horrible price for. Londo effectively sacrificed that guy because he wanted to dodge taking the position.
I think that it's getting into some really creepy territory, the way that they're using the region. But that scene was really well done. And yeah, I don't know. We're coming up on the 50-minute mark, so I think we should probably
Wrap it up.
wrap it up. But did you have any other thoughts on these episodes before we head out?
No, I think I'm good.
Yeah, no, I thought these were some solid. One of them was like a solitary episode. The other two were part of a longer storyline, and it all worked for me. So I'm looking forward to the next episode, and I guess we'll be back on Friday with our discussion of a Chinese ghost story, and then we'll probably be back over the weekend with more Babylon 5, and we have a podcast up of our last Lady 87 session. There was an enormous issue with the recording, and so. The first part of it, I think, is basically fine, but some point midway through the recording, things get a little weird, so you might have trouble understanding exactly what's going on. But it's up there so that we have a record of the session, and people that have been following it can listen to it. The video version seems to be relatively intact, so we might post that up on YouTube if we are able to. And then if people are really curious about what happens at the end of the session, they can check that out. So we will be back on Friday, and we will talk to you later.